If you like First Person, you'll love Deep Dish on Global Affairs, a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues. Subscribe to Deep Dish on Global Affairs today, wherever you get your podcasts.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the diplomat whose life and death symbolized the American century. Richard Holbrooke was a long-serving diplomat. His life spanned the period of America's dominance in the world. Born during World War II, he served twice as Assistant Secretary of State and died from a heart attack in 2010 while acting as the U.S. Special Representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. The sheer force of his personality helped bring about the Dayton Accords, which ushered in an end to the Balkan Wars in the 1990s.
We've got a window of opportunity, which is small, and a window of danger, which is large. It's an uphill struggle, but we are committed to it, and we think there's a chance.
George Packer, an award-winning journalist who writes for The Atlantic, has a new biography just out on Holbrooke. It's titled Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century. In it, he argues that Holbrooke represented America's best and worst impulses, and that the two were inseparable from each other. Our feeling that we could do anything gave us the Marshall Plan and Vietnam, the peace at Dayton, and the endless Afghan war, Packer writes. Our confidence and energy, our reach and grasp, our excess and blindness, they were not so different from Holbrooke's. He was our man. That's the reason to tell you his story. Holbrooke was also the editor of Foreign Policy from 1972 to 1976. This week, FP columnist Stephen Walt sat down with Packer to discuss the book and discovered they had something in common.
Howdy. Stephen?
Yes, George.
Hi.
Very nice. I don't think we've ever met.
We have never met.
But you're from the Bay Area?
This is my first question. Where did you graduate from high school?
Gunn.
Class of 73.
Are you kidding me?
Nice to meet you.
Because when Dan said you were from Los Altos, I thought, well, that can't be Gunn. But Los Altos...
Eventually, they got down to talking about Holbrooke. Great.
So let me start by telling listeners that the book is well worth their time. It really is a terrific read, and Holbrooke is, without question, a fascinating figure. But as I read it, I kept having this line that popped into my head. This is, in some ways, the strangest love letter I had ever read, in the sense that you knew Holbrooke reasonably well. You clearly admired him, but you also do not whitewash him at all. The vices are there as long as the virtues. So tell me a little bit about your relationship with him.
I mean, you know, he cultivated journalists and used them, and they were happy to be used by him because they used him back. He loved journalists. He was more comfortable with them than with government officials, I think. He wanted to be one, and it was kind of a lifelong romance he had with different generations of journalists. I didn't know him all that well. I wrote a profile of him in 2009 for The New Yorker when he was President Obama's representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I look back on that, it's not my finest work. I did not see what was really going on with him, which I learned much later when I wrote this book. So we were social acquaintances, and in his presence, you were sort of mesmerized and wanted to watch him and see what he would do next with a combination of wonder and apprehension. But we weren't close.
Okay. Well, and what was the nature of that? You write about sort of hearing his voice. His voice is still in his head. What was the voice? What was the thing that keeps pulsating in your head?
It just had this pressure. You felt cornered by it. You couldn't get away from it. He wanted something from you. It wasn't loud. It wasn't particularly urgent in tone. But I describe it as an underwater current, kind of invisible but powerful. And it would wash you far away from where you thought you wanted to be before you even knew it. He was always doing something to you. He always had some agenda with you. And I symbolize that power of his will in the quality of his voice, which felt almost like a physical force that you wanted maybe to get out of the way of because you would end up getting caught in it.
One way of reading the book is as Holbrooke is in some ways a tragic figure, that he's got all of these strengths, all of these talents, immense energy. Everybody who deals with him understands that. But at the same time, he's handicapped by this set of personal qualities that is constantly undermining his own ambitions. You write in the preface, it's an unusual preface for a biography because it is quite personal, talking about wishing you could sort of reach inside and fix what was wrong, but then saying, you know, if I'd fixed that, we would have lost what made him almost great. What are some examples of the bad behavior that got in his own way?
The main original sin of his bad behavior was lack of self-awareness, I would say, self-blindness. For a man of incredible analytical power and insight into other people, he couldn't see himself. He didn't want to see himself. When you asked him questions about, say, his parents or his motivations or his psyche, those were the questions he really hated. He did not like to look at his past or at himself. He was always moving forward and always moving outward. So that seems like, in some ways, an advantage. It means you are the one in motion and your adversary or your counterpart is sort of receiving the action. But it turns out that without self-awareness, you can destroy yourself. And Holbrook didn't see the effect he was having on other people. And related to that, he had a streak of cruelty. I mean, he could be cruel to people. He could be dismissive. I was once on stage with him when he just took a swipe at me out of nowhere and seemed totally gratuitous and embarrassed me in front of people who I cared about. I can't tell you how many interviews I did in which that was the first thing out of the mouth of the person I was talking to, a story like that. The landscape was littered with Holbrook insults or disdain or looking for someone more important to talk to.
And do you really think he was completely unaware of it? There are several times in the book where he writes to one of his wives about, you know, I've learned I'm not going to be crazy the way I was. I no longer aspire to some of these things. And your suggestion is this was maybe self-deception.
Yeah, it was self-deception. And it often is women. I think he was more himself with women because he wasn't in competitive mode with them all the time, as he often was with men. But this was with a man, a friend. They're driving through Spain. It's 1972. They're going to go skiing. This is Jeffrey Wolfe, who's a novelist and a friend of Holbrook's. And Holbrook had lots of writer friends and even wrote a bad ripoff of Graham Greene at one point, which Jeffrey Wolfe told him, you know, right, you should stick to your job as a diplomat. And Holbrook said, I know how people see me. They're in this car. It's at night. It's a long drive. Things become a bit confessional. Holbrook said, I know how people see me, that I'm really ambitious and ruthless and all elbows. And it's not who I am anymore. That's not how I'm going to live my life. But, you know, within a few months, he's telling a girlfriend, because this is the moment when his first marriage ends and he becomes a wild single man in Washington. He tells a girlfriend who asks him how he sees himself in the next 5 years, I'm going to be the next Henry Kissinger. So how long did that moment of self-awareness last, and how deep did it go? They were never very deep, and he was always moving on to the next conquest.
So let's go back a little bit. So he begins his career in Vietnam, in rural affairs, at a remarkably young age. You know, I keep thinking, you know, what was I doing at 22, 23? And there he is off, you know, providing aid as part of what we would now call nation building.
He was doing nation building. He was doing civilian counterinsurgency. He was the top American civilian in this very hot province with the Viet Cong all around, and he was 22 years old.
Yeah. He's quickly spotted as a very able, very capable young guy. What are the lessons he took from Vietnam? Because in a sense, they shape much of the rest of his career.
Yeah, the book is organized around three wars, which each gets a very long section: Vietnam, Bosnia, Afghanistan. And really, Vietnam was the key to everything. He learned right away, because he had a really clear and unafraid intelligence, that we were losing, that the military reports going to Saigon and from Saigon to Washington were misleading, if not outright false, that that was costing us, because if the assessments are wrong, they're leading to wrong strategies and tactics. He realized the tactics were costing us the war, because we were coming into these hamlets with helicopter gunships and overwhelming firepower and shooting at anyone on the ground who was moving, regardless of whether they were Viet Cong or, I mean, by now we know all this from watching Apocalypse Now and Platoon, but this was 1963. We were the good guys. We were coming in to save a brave people who only wanted to be left alone from this communist aggression coming from the North. That was a nearly universal view of Vietnam at that point, including among the journalists who became the war's biggest critics. So to be totally against this war would have made Holbrooke an absolute freak. He wasn't. But what he saw was how badly it was being fought and how wrongly. He wanted a more intelligent war. He wanted a war of restraint and of nation building and of hearts and minds. And that was what his job was in the Mekong Delta.
And in what sense does then that shape the worldview going forward, you know, sort of the rest of his career?
It's complicated because for some Americans, that was the end of their faith in counterinsurgency and really in America's ability to work its will in some messy foreign war. That's not the lesson Holbrooke took. He became a skeptic of the military and of the militarization of foreign policy. He saw the diplomats being pushed aside by Westmoreland and the generals, and he didn't like that. He wanted to be
right.
the center of the policy. And that became a lasting lesson, as well as that lesson about needing to be on the ground in order to see the truth and not believe the reports. But he did not take the lesson that we should stay out. He took him 4 years to realize we can't win. He had to go back to the United States and see that the war was tearing up the country and we would not have public support long enough to win and Hanoi would outlast us. And that's when he learned the next lesson, which is you've got to talk to the enemy. You cannot shoot your way to victory. You have to talk. And he became part of the Paris peace talks under Averell Harriman, which went nowhere. And that was pretty much the end of his years working on Vietnam. But I would say he moved on, as always, without being devastated by this experience. Other people were, but he continued to believe in himself and in America as the center of everything. It's just that we need to be careful and prudent and skeptical of too much happy talk, but we can't step aside. He never believed that.
So the great triumph of his career, of course, is negotiating the end to the Bosnian War, Dayton Accords. And you describe that in great detail and how the sort of force of personality, ability to talk out of both sides of his mouth at the right time all came in
handy. You can say his negative qualities were his positive ones in Bosnia.
In that circumstance, dealing with a bunch of Balkan politicians, he had exactly the right skill set. The Balkans, as you point out, remain deeply troubled. However, it was not a miracle solution that led to sort of a fully happy ending. But as you tell the tale, this triumph was also built on another lie, at least in part, which is the story of the tragedy on Mount Tigman, the accident in which three members of his party are killed when their car goes over an edge, and where your account in it is different than the account in Holbrooke's own memoir.
Yeah.
This is a story I think no one had heard about until you told us. So I want to know, first of all, how you found out the story, and then tell us what he said and then what actually happened.
Right. So we haven't talked about how I came to write this book, but I was given his personal papers by his widow, Kati Martin, right after his death. So I had them in my home office for years and years, and I was going through diaries and letters and audio tapes. It was quite a lot of stuff. And in one folder, I found a letter to Holbrooke from a Lieutenant Colonel Randall Bankey, who I'd never heard of. And it was very polite, but it was forceful. And it said, basically, your book on Bosnia, which has just come out to end a war, does me a great disservice because you say that as your military escort on Mount Igman, when you and your team were trying to get into Sarajevo, this is August 95, I disappeared as if I had abandoned you. And all my friends think that I ran away, which is like the death knell for
a
military
career.
The worst thing a soldier could do. What I did was, and then he attached a statement he had made to the UN investigation that was done on the accident within a few days of the deaths of those three diplomats. Here's what I was doing. And what he was doing was going down the mountain into what seemed like possible gunfire and landmines in order to rescue the people in the APC that had rolled off the road and down the mountain. For 2 hours, it was heroic. He was carrying stretchers. He was trying to put out fires. He was trying to get people out of the burning vehicle.
With exploding ammunition.
He was risking his life. And at one point, he thought he was going to lose his life. So I didn't know what this all meant. But Holbrooke had kept that letter, which is interesting. He did not just immediately incinerate it. I found Colonel Bankey, who is now a retired colonel. He lives in Luxembourg. And at first he was wary, but eventually I convinced him that I wanted to tell the real story. So we spent hours talking by Skype. And basically, we recreated what happened. And I also interviewed everyone else I could find who was on the mountain that day. Holbrooke had written Banky out of the story in a way that dishonored Banky. And Banky was passed over for promotion.
Yeah, it ends his military career.
It may well have cost him his career. And he actually gave the letter I found to Holbrooke on Holbrooke's book tour and said, "Do you remember me?" And Holbrooke basically blew him off. We recreated what happened as well as I could using Banky's account and other people's. And so I wrote the story twice. I didn't know quite how to do this. So what I ended up doing was writing Holbrooke's version and then the version that I have reported. And I also went to Sarajevo and spent a day on Mount Igman and retraced everything. And it's a kind of scandal that Holbrooke took Banky's heroics and essentially gave them to himself and to General Wesley Clark, who were not dishonorable. They were both doing what they were supposed to do that day, but they were not doing what Randall Banky was doing. And so Banky's actions became the actions of the great men on the mountain. Right. And I was interested in this because it told me this is kind of how history gets written. The Randall Bankys don't write it. The Richard Holbrooks write it. And for years, this was the only version anyone knew, Holbrooke's version. And Holbrooke gave it to Clinton when they called Washington or the U.S. from the embassy in Sarajevo later that day of the accident. And it immediately became like the founding myth for the peace effort. We've lost three great colleagues. We cannot have their deaths be in vain. We must continue with this effort. And in fact, it finally got Clinton involved in Bosnia because it now had, he had skin in the game. So Holbrooke used a lie to, in some ways, power his own and America's involvement toward the peace. He would have said, "Yo, isn't it worth it?" And I would say, "No, it's not, because there's a guy named Randall Banky who you've wronged."
Right. If there's a tragedy in this story, it's the people like Banky, not so much the heroic figure, as it were.
If you like First Person, you'll love Deep Dish on Global Affairs, a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues. Each episode has new guests, like Israeli security experts explaining cyber terrorism, or Hollywood producers covering China's influence over the U.S. box office. Deep Dish describes what's happening, why it matters, and what to watch as the story unfolds. Subscribe to Deep Dish on Global Affairs today, wherever you get your podcasts.
So another feature of this book is there's a portrait of the, let's call it the foreign policy elite or the foreign policy establishment throughout the book. He's obviously a member of it, has a delicate relationship, maybe to put it politely, with many of them. But it's not a very flattering picture. There are a lot of small, very, I think, piercing characterizations of key figures. In a sense, nobody comes off well. Not wow. Zbigniew Brzezinski, not Anthony Lake, ultimately.
I would say Lake comes off as a more decent human being than Richard Holbrooke, and often the victim of Richard Holbrooke's aggressive tactics. He has his own flaws and his own policy mistakes that he has to answer to history for. Bosnia, he wanted to get us involved, but he had to work for Bill Clinton, who wanted nothing to do with it, and so Lake couldn't get us involved. But you're right that the portraits are pretty they're unvarnished. And
it's worse than that. I mean, you're right, and it's a great sense that the nation's vital business is carried out amid humiliating pettiness. And there's an awful lot of that. But you also have a variety of, let's just say, you know, jabs at almost everyone who comes across the page, right? Were there people in the writing of the book who rose in your estimation? You came away feeling better about them than you had when you started.
I think what this shows is how there's a layer of falseness over most writing about powerful people in government, certainly in their own writing. One thing I learned in reading some of the memoirs of the characters in this book is just not to trust them. Obviously, we shouldn't, But it's not just that they put themselves at the center of things and in a better light. It's that they can't really reveal who they are, because when you get to the top, you don't get there simply by being a good public servant. That's part of it. But ambition is not a pretty thing. It is a frightening force, especially when you see it absolutely unchained in someone like Holbrooke. But they're all ambitious, and government does something to them. And it's not just because they're petty. It's because the stakes are incredibly high. America has all this power. They're scrambling for a limited number of positions. Their policy arguments become bitterly personal. And in fact, I feel like foreign policy making is mainly about human character. I mean, they don't really know what they're doing. They don't have enough information about the rest of the world to make absolutely objective, detached, clinical decisions. It's biases, it's ideologies, it's impulses, it's ambitions, it's politics. I think foreign policy, more than domestic policy, is driven just by the character of the people involved. And government can destroy you. I mean, and many people in this book are, if not absolutely destroyed, they're at least really damaged by it. It gives me some sympathy for them, because I think they're not bad people. It's that government is an arena that brings this out. And I think most accounts of it don't portray it accurately. I think there's a gloss that I wanted to strip off to show what it's really like.
So maybe a more pointed way of asking this is, you know, one way of reading the book is to say, again, a man with great strengths, great weaknesses. Sort of, do you have to be an insufferable egomaniac driven in this way to succeed? Is the nature of the task.
You don't. You don't. And that was one review suggested that, and I think it was wrong, because Holbrooke, in him, these two qualities are inseparable. His idealism and his egotism, wrapped up in ambition, were two parts of the same whole. And if you tried to fix him, you would destroy him. You'd make him incapable. But that doesn't mean everyone has to be Richard Holbrooke. And there are many successful policymakers, politicians, who are not Richard Holbrooke. I mean, Barack Obama is the opposite of Richard Holbrooke in many ways. And he's a historic figure. So, no, I would not go, it's not that Hobbesian. But in the wake of Holbrooke, it seems like it just churns up a lot of blood and bile. And it may also make the other animals in the forest a little wilder themselves, because they're aware that there's a predator out there, and they are all kind of at the extreme of their nerves.
Watching.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, though, of, you know, one of the things that Holbrooke was clearly extremely gifted at was the dark arts of deception. Right?
Yes.
He was an inveterate leaker. He saved his career when he was assistant secretary in East Asia. You might want to tell us that story by essentially planting a false story about Soviet disinformation.
But so this is interesting, because the guy who was trying to kill his career was Brzezinski. The story begins when Carter gets elected. Holbrooke, who was a key member of his campaign, Carter calls Holbrooke after the election and says, what do you think of my ideas for various offices? Cyrus Vance for Secretary of State. Wonderful. Zbigniew Brzezinski for National Security Advisor. Holbrooke hesitates and then decides to tell him the truth. He and Vance will never get along. They have different styles, different visions. Carter doesn't want to hear that, hangs up. The word gets back to Brzezinski, who spends the next 4 years trying to destroy Richard Holbrooke. When Holbrooke is working on the normalization of relations with China, along with Brzezinski, but really being shoved aside by Brzezinski, and with Vietnam at the same time, a story comes out that he was talking to the Vietnamese ambassador in Laos and saying things about Washington's decision-making that went against policy. Gets back to Brzezinski, who goes in to tell Carter, you must fire him. He's insubordinate. This word gets to Holbrooke when he's now in Burma. He's traveling through Southeast Asia. And Holbrooke goes into the embassy in Rangoon with an old friend from Vietnam, and they concoct a CIA cable that says this was a piece of Russian disinformation that Brzezinski fell for. It's a lie. It's a good lie,
right.
And it works. It saves his job.
Right.
So who's the—
And then I guess, and he leaks the story then—
To Evans and Novak, who write a column about how Brzezinski was duped by Soviet counter-propaganda. And
the question is, how does any of this, I'm not defending Brzezinski for a moment, but how does any of this advance the national interest?
It doesn't.
As you mentioned a while back, Holbrooke told one girlfriend that he wanted to be the next Kissinger. But you're reading the book, again, you get the sense that actually that wasn't what he could have been.
He could not have.
That he was not a strategist. He was a tactician. If you put a problem in front of him, he could throw enormous energy, intellect, drive towards solving that particular problem. But he didn't have a particular worldview, didn't have a sense of how the tectonic plates of global politics really fit together, although he claimed to. But there's no evidence of that. And in fact, when you see the missteps, whether, you know, in Asia, that he's putting more emphasis on normalization with Vietnam than what really matters, which is normalizing with China, that he does.
He wanted both, but Brzezinski was saying we can't have both because the Chinese won't let us. So we're going to go with China.
That's right. He was a man of great talents, but limited vision, I guess.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And by the way, that girlfriend dropped him on the spot because she knew Henry Kissinger. And did not want to be married to the next.
I knew Henry Kissinger.
He was no Henry Kissinger. He was not a geostrategist. He wasn't interested in Soviet-American relations, particularly, which was the governing issue.
Or Middle East politics.
He wouldn't touch that more out of just a kind of instinctive sense that this could only be bad for his career if he got involved. It was the only part of the world that he just carefully stayed out of. And after Iraq turned into a disaster, he also didn't want to hear about Iraq any longer. But you're right. He did not have that strategic intelligence. And if he had become Secretary of State, he would have put his energy into solving particular problems rather than trying to see 20 or 30 years ahead like Kissinger and remake our position in relation to other countries. He wanted to be able in some ways to be the protagonist of a great diplomatic story, and that meant being in the center of a very dramatic situation, and that was where his career, you know, came to its most important moments.
Right. One of the moments you don't talk very much about in the book is that his role in driving the process of NATO expansion, shifting U.S. policy from what was the original proposal of Partnership for Peace, and that was what the Pentagon wanted, that was where Clinton was headed, and in at least some versions of that story, Holbrooke is as important as anyone in shifting Clinton pushing it forward.
And absolutely. He wrote an essay, America, a European Power. He thought NATO expanding to the borders of Russia could only be good for Europe and in the end for Russia. He didn't think it was a threat to Russia, and he and Henry Kissinger argued about this. Right. Holbrooke didn't even foresee, I don't think, that Russia might regard itself as being encircled and its area of influence being encroached on. But the thing that he did care about that Kissinger did not was humanitarianism. And this may have clouded his judgment about things like normalization with Vietnam, but it also made him a very powerful advocate for issues that most policymakers didn't even think about very much. In the late 70s, it was refugees. When the Vietnamese were taken to the South China Sea in flimsy boats and dying by the thousands, Jimmy Carter didn't want to hear about it. We wanted to forget about Vietnam at that point, and Holbrooke put it front and center. And with Walter Mondale, made it an issue that the Carter administration took on and eventually created the Refugee Act of 1980. And then in later years, it was AIDS, at which he put before the UN Security Council as an issue that the world had to take more seriously than just as something for the NGOs. And I think if he'd lived, global warming would have been an issue that he took on as a national security issue too. I think in some ways he was ahead of his time in seeing these softer, whatever you want to call them, transnational threats as part of our interest as a power.
Well, this to me is actually a puzzle, because here's a guy who, if nothing else, in Vietnam, he learns both maybe what American power can do, but also very much the limits of American power, that there are just real limits to how much you can remake another society.
Yes.
That you might be able to do it if you have a lot of time and you're very subtle and you're very smart, but these other countries are resistant to it, especially if you're dealing with a corrupt government that you're as your partner.
And there's a paradox, which is the harder you're trying, the less they're doing. The more they're dependent on you, the more it's your war and not their war, and the more the enemy makes it a war of nationalism rather than a war against aggression.
And yet, if that's the founding set of lessons he takes from it, he supports the Iraq War in 2003.
Yes.
Without having...
That was just a political decision because he wanted to be John Kerry's Secretary of State.
Okay. But that's like the worst reason to support a major war.
Indeed.
And then he also, as realistic as he may have been about our prospects in Afghanistan, he nonetheless thinks that he can pull it off. You know, I think you write at one point that, you know, he knew from Vietnam that we were likely to fail, but he still thought he could do it.
Yeah, that's a very complicated situation because he brought Vietnam into the Situation Room and tried to put it right on the table in front of Barack Obama. And he pontificated and lectured and made photocopies of his ghost-written book, Autobiography of Clark Clifford, which Holbrooke wrote, right, to show everyone that in 1965, Lyndon Johnson was facing the same dilemma about escalation that Barack Obama was facing in Afghanistan. And most of the people in the room were absolutely uninterested in, and didn't want to be lectured this way. It was the wrong approach, and Obama above all. He also was flattering Obama. He was doing everything wrong with Barack Obama and immediately lost the trust of the president and never got it back right at the start. But Holbrooke had a job, and his job was to be, in the Vietnam era, it was called CORDS, and in Afghanistan, it was called SRAP, the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was in charge of the civilian side of this war, which meant police reform, agriculture, and prisons, and diplomacy, and politics, and trying to oversee the American handling of the election in Kabul, which he totally bungled. He tried to get rid of Hamid Karzai because he thought his corruption was making the war unwinnable, and instead Karzai outmaneuvered him and stayed in power. This was his job, and so once Holbrooke had a job, he couldn't not believe in himself. So there's a kind of double think. I know this won't work, but I'm Richard Holbrooke, and this is my job, and so I'm going to make it work or try like hell. There's another side to it that redeems this somewhat. He also knew that the surge was not going to work and that the heavy military emphasis of the Obama administration was doomed, and he knew that from Vietnam. So we had to talk to the Taliban, and he couldn't push for that because no one else wanted it, and he didn't have the standing. He was too unpopular to push, especially because he depended on his boss, Hillary Clinton, who was his only supporter in the administration, and she didn't want it. So it took him almost to the end of his life before he can even begin to bring this policy forward, and by then it was too late for him. And so you could say, yeah, there's a tragedy in this, a lost opportunity, but also someone else might have resigned. Someone else might have said, this won't work, and I'm not going to push for a policy that is doomed to fail. Holbrooke was incapable of that. And so when people asked him, why the hell don't you get out? Because his friends saw that it was literally killing him. He was in terrible health. His color was bad. His weight was bad. His psyche was bad. He was depressed. And his friends said, get out. And he would say, as long as I can be of some use, as long as I can try to get the president to see a way towards some resolution, I can't. So he put it in terms of duty, which was part of it. He did have a very high sense of duty and of patriotism, but it was also ambition. This was what he wanted to do.
That's a great segue to something else I wanted to ask you. So the title of the book, Our Man, and then The End of the American Century. So first of all, whose man is he? And why did you use that as a subtitle?
Well, the title was like the end of a series of failed titles. I wanted the title to give the reader the sense of what this book would be like to read, which is to say somewhat like a novel with a really big, outsized, maddening, mesmerizing protagonist. I thought of Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana, right, and was thinking of Our Man in Kabul, but he was also, he wasn't really Our Man in Kabul. He was everywhere and not really anywhere. And I finally just stopped at Our Man and realized that, which at first didn't seem like a title at all, might be the right one because he does embody some very admirable and some very unadmirable American traits. The energy and confidence that he showed throughout his life, the overconfidence, the hubris, the blindness to some realities, including about himself, and the sense that we had to be at the center, and he had to be at the center. He was our man in that sense.
That's a good way to put it. So I want to thank George Packer for being with me today. I just want to remind everybody this is a really terrific, very entertaining, very insightful book in a number of ways, and I'm grateful for the chance to talk to you about it.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Stephen.
That was FP columnist Stephen Walt interviewing George Packer about his book, Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century. Stephen Walt is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway. Rob Sachs is our editor, and Dan Efron is our executive editor for news and podcasts. We'll be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.
If you like First Person, you'll love Deep Dish on Global Affairs, a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical global issues. Subscribe to Deep Dish on Global Affairs today, wherever you get your podcasts.